series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Jean-Marie Gaynaud, Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations at the United Nations, delivered a 2008-2009 Sherrill Lecture titled Peacekeeping, Testing the Limits of the Concept of an International Community. As Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping Operations at the UN, Jean-Marie Gaynaud played a pathbreaking role. He led the biggest expansion of peacekeeping in the history of the United Nations and has been at the forefront of efforts to address the conflicts of Africa, from the Democratic Republic of the Congo to Darfur, as well as strategic challenges from Afghanistan to Kosovo and Georgia.
Thank you for your very kind words. I mean, listening to this very distinguished series of speakers, I mean, it's daunting. But I would say the only justification for me being here today is that peacekeeping actually does matter. Peacekeeping has become probably the most visible activity of the United Nations. Today it involves close to 140,000 people, military, police, civilians. So it's that figure that represents roughly twice what NATO deploys around the world, and in numbers it's second only to the United States, although the organization that runs it, the Department of Peacekeeping Operation, would just be a tiny little piece of the Pentagon. It could fill in a few rooms of the Pentagon. Even expanded, it's about 1,000 people. So I think what in the Pentagon, which is just a very small part of headquarters, you have probably some 20 or 30,000 people working. So let's not get carried away by comparisons. But it is indeed big. It represents a huge operational responsibility for the United Nations. And it has raised enormous expectations Now one talks about the peacekeepers as if they were the new international police of the world. And so the reason why I picked the title Testing the Limits of the Concept of an International Community is really how far are we in that international community? What can we expect from the United Nations, and what are we prepared to commit for this United Nations, because the United Nations is the most ambiguous and misleading two words that can be put together. I mean, is the UN, is it the member states? Is it the people behind the member states? Is it the secretariat? Is it the Security Council, the true contributors? Well, it is all of the above when it is successful. It is the secretariat when it fails. It does matter to answer what peacekeeping can be today, because it reflects the failings, the limits, but also the ambitions of the international community. And maybe to start, I should go back to what the drafters of the Charter of the United Nations had in mind, which was very different when it comes to military force from what actually developed. Their views were, of course, shaped by World War II. They were shaped by World War II and by the way World War II happened. That is, a notion of collective responsibility in the League of Nations. That was a very weak notion, because the responsibility of all meant the responsibility of nobody. And so when someone like Hitler rose, there was no collective will to address the challenge of Hitler. And so that's the reason why they decided to entrust specific responsibilities to a small group of nations. In a way, the extension of the alliance of the war, the United Nations, united against the Nazis, against the powers of the Axis initially, that would continue to have special responsibilities after the war. And that would be ready to use all means, including force, including overwhelming force, and that's why there is a chapter 7 in the Charter. If a new threat to peace emerge, a new Hitler emerge. And their view was certainly that the use of force would be the exception, but that if force was used, it could go all the way, as it did against Hitler. And the basic deal was a compromise that you are familiar with, that yes, the world would be governed by rules, but the relations between states would be governed by rules, but what happened within a state would not be the purview of the international community. And that was the basic compromise of the UN Charter, although, and you are all familiar with it, if one looks at it, it talks about we the people, it says a number of things that try to go beyond that compromise, beyond a narrow vision of just relations between states, but nevertheless, the essential institutional compromise was that. Relations between states will be ruled by law. What happens within states, that is not is fundamentally for the UN to address. Now, for 45 years, that vision could not really be tested because there was the Cold War, because the alliance of World War II had fractured. And I would posit that, in a way, the first Kuwait War, the first Gulf War, is the closest one gets to the initial vision of the Charter. Of course, one can stress that the multinational force that kicked Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait was a multinational force. There was no role of the military committee provided for in the Charter. It was US-led. So there are big differences with what was thought of in the Charter. But nevertheless, I think in spirit, it probably comes as close as it gets to the vision of the Charter. There's a blatant challenge to the rule of law in relations between states. A country is invaded by another country, and forceful action is taken to redress that abuse. Now, what's interesting, it's the one and only situation where that initial vision, in a way, was tested. It's that fleeting moment when one was talking about a new world order at the end of the Cold War. As we all know, the second Iraq War was not formally sanctioned by the Security Council. The Kosovo War happened without the blessing of the Security Council. It's the post-war phase that was authorized by the Council. So this this Gulf War to liberate Kuwait stands more as an exception than as a rule. And at the same time, in those 45 years, and even more in the years since, in the 19 years that have elapsed since the end of the Cold War, there is a military role for the UN, but a very different one from the one envisaged by the drafters of the Charter, and that's called peacekeeping. And as you may know, the word peacekeeping is not even in the Charter. Like many important new ideas, it's a creation of events, of history, also of envisioned people, people with a vision, rather than an institutional creation of 1945. Peacekeeping is a revolutionary idea, not because it would pave the way to some kind of utopian view of a world government. Actually, what is revolutionary in peacekeeping is precisely the notion that what happens at the level of the international community is fundamentally different from what happens at the level of states, that it's helping countries rebuild themselves using force in a political sense is quite different from the use of force to police the world. Peacekeeping, when we look at it, when we look at the development of this idea over the last 60 years, as I said, it's been shaped by events rather than initial contact. And it's still being shaped by events. I would say the birth of peacekeeping is probably, I would say it's more Suez than 1948, than the first Israel-Arab War. The first peacekeepers, in a way, they are the observers deployed to supervise the truce when the Israel-Arab War ends. But the first form units with blue helmets, that is when the Suez expedition happens, when the Suez crisis happens. And it's interesting, when think about it, it's exactly the opposite of what the drafters of the charter had envisaged. Because what do you have at Suez? You have two of the permanent members of the Council, the United Kingdom and France, which are part of the problem, in a way, which are part of the crisis with Israel. They have moved to the canal on somewhat flimsy, on a somewhat legally flimsy basis. So the issue there is that those countries that in the charter are expected to be the policemen of the world, I mean, if they certainly cannot be in that particular situation of Suez. It can be any country but a member of the Security Council, certainly not Britain and France. And so what the Foreign Minister of Canada at the time, Lester Pearson, the Secretary General, Dagmar Schild, and the man who probably is the inventor of peacekeeping, Ralph Bunche, although with Brian Urquhart, actually, who helped shape the ideas of peacekeeping. But what they put together is a force whose strength, in a way, will be its weakness, whose weakness will be its strength. That is a force that is not militarily going to push back the French and the British, but that is going to give the political cover for withdrawal of the forces that are on the canal. So it's a political use of a military force. And that particular aspect is going to be there for the whole life of peacekeeping, that political use of force. And that's really where peacekeeping is a very interesting and revolutionary idea. When a few years later, there is the one big operation of the only one, really big operation of the Cold War, the first operation in Congo. You can say there is a much more operational use of force. There are fighter planes, Swedish fighter planes in the force. They are fighting forces which actually perform very operational tasks. But nevertheless, when you compare what they are doing to the initial vision of repelling Hitler, this is quite different. This is a much more modest use of force. This is certainly not overwhelming force. It's a force that is trying to shore up a state that could break up if Katanga were to secede. And so the force is permanently connected to a certain political vision, sending political signals as well as playing an operational role. Then you have the end of the Cold War, and a sense that this particular form of military activity of the UN is no more paralyzed by the divides, the divisions of the Council. And you have a remarkable expansion of peacekeeping. And I would want to mention a number of operations just because they are forgotten, because successes are always forgotten. When you think of what happened in Mozambique, in Namibia, in El Salvador, even in Cambodia, these are countries that today still have a number of problems. They're far from having solved everything. But certainly, conflicts in all those countries has ended, and this was linked to the deployment of peacekeeping operations in those countries. But what one remembers, of course, are the three tragedies and disasters of Yugoslavia, of Somalia, and of Rwanda. And so you have this first phase of peacekeeping starting in the early 90s with a formidable growth, which stops brutally in the mid-90s. And if I had been asked to give that lecture in 96, Probably, I mean, I would have reflected common wisdom if I had said, well, UN peacekeeping for all practical matter is dead. The future is with regional organizations. UN will be maybe a convening, will have a convening role, but the operational role of UN peacekeepers, that died with the Rwandan genocide and Srebrenica and Mogadishu. Come 99, you have Kosovo, you have Timor, you have Congo. Myself, I joined the United Nations in 2000 to be, in a way, the implementer of what is called the Brahimi Report. I mean, it's the name of the distinguished former Algerian foreign minister who chaired a commission that very honestly reflected on what went wrong in the 90s and made recommendations to prevent the such failures to come again. And a set of recommendations was about professionalizing the United Nations, recognizing that peacekeeping is a core activity of the UN, not something that you do on an exceptional basis. And so if it's a core activity, it has to be taken seriously. It has to have the right support structure. And part of my role was to develop that support structure. But another part of the recommendation was to say, well, peacekeeping, it's a political effort. And so the Security Council, when it authorizes a peacekeeping mission, has to be wise about it. It has to recognize that peacekeeping is an important tool, but it's not a universal tool, that political use of military force there has to be the political conditions for political use of military force. In other words, there has to be some peace to keep. There has to be adequate resources provided by member states. There has to be realistic mandates. And on that basis, many new peacekeeping operations were authorized or expanded. And we saw progress in some places. I think of where Sierra Leone, or Liberia, even Cote d'Ivoire are today. I think even Haiti is probably in better shape today than a few years ago. But at the same time, you're all thinking about what's going on in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, what's going on in Darfur, and is the UN going to come to go to Somalia? So we are at an interesting time. Sometimes I wish it was less interesting. We are at an interesting time where the question is peacekeeping going to go through another boom and bust cycle? Or can this important instrument of the international community be stabilized to play a useful role without breaking itself and without being useless? And so that raises the question, where are we really today in terms of peacekeeping? And I would say that certainly the UN, the United Nations, the instrument, is a stronger structure today than it was 8 years ago. It is better resourced. There have been real reforms in that particular part of the United Nations. And there is a better understanding of the link between ending conflicts and deployment of peacekeeping operation. Actually, contrary to popular view, which believes that there are more and more conflicts, when you look at statistics, and there have been studies on that, you see that the number of conflicts today is much less than 20 years ago. And you can establish some link between the deployment of peacekeeping operation to support fragile peace, and this good statistics in terms of number of conflicts. But at the same time, the transformation of peacekeeping from an activity that was essentially during the Cold War, with the big exception of the first Congo operation, but essentially an effort dealing with relations between states, to an activity that more and more is involved in intrastate conflict, that evolution calls into question the initial compromise, the initial deal that I mentioned at the outset. And we see it in the debate, in the political debate on what is the role of the international community. Some of you may be familiar with the resolution that is often quoted by the humanitarian community, Resolution 688 of 1991. That's a resolution that addressed the problem of the Kurds in Iraq and called upon the international community to provide humanitarian aid to the Kurds of Iraq. It's a resolution on which China abstained, and it's a resolution that duly noted that what was happening in Iraq was a threat to international peace and security. So it was a finely balanced resolution. That was a step forward. There was a domestic situation in Iraq that was under the purview of the Security Council, but at the same time, all sorts of precautions were taken. Now, when you compare the language of that resolution to the language of the outcome document of the World Summit of 2005, you can say, oh, the International Committee has really made a radical move. I mean, I'm not going to quote the whole paragraph of the summit declaration that relates to those issues, but I would want to quote one sentence, which says, "We are prepared to take collective action in a timely and decisive manner through the Security Council in accordance with the Charter, including Chapter 7, on a case-by-case basis, should peaceful means be inadequate and national authorities manifestly fail to protect their populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crime against humanity." If I quoted the whole paragraph, you would have a better idea of how difficult the negotiation that led to that text was, because there are all sorts of caveats, even in the sentence that I quoted with the case by case and a variety of things. I mean, you are students of law, so I don't need to emphasize that to you. I mean, there are all sorts of precautions in that text to protect various positions of member states, and Pakistan during the discussion was a very difficult deal that was being negotiated. Nevertheless, that text happens after the whole debate on the responsibility to protect, and reads very differently from the text of Resolution 688, and it really raises for us the fundamental question, because what it describes is something that goes way beyond peacekeeping as I have described it, that goes beyond what the drafters of the Charter had in mind, relations between states, that really goes to something, to the inner workings of states and communities, and that allows, of course, you know, on a subsidiary basis, if all other means have failed, but nevertheless raises the possibility of forceful action by the international community. So it's a very ambitious text. There is no question about it, even with all the precautions that are embedded in it. Now, is the world really there? You have different views on that. You have some people who would say that, in a way, it is, and they note other important elements that you're familiar with: the creation of the International Criminal Court, the evolution of what the International Criminal Court does, the fact that the International Criminal Court started by indicting. Some militia leaders in Congo, and I can say, I mean, how helpful it was, actually. There was indictment. Then there was the indictment of Charles Taylor, a fallen dictator, and now there are discussions on the possible indictment of a sitting head of state. So you can draw the conclusion from that there is really an emerging norm, as you would say, that is extending the role of the international community and the institutional role of the international community. You have others who would say that, yes, all that it's true is partly true, but at the same time, in the United Nations, there are some fundamental institutional roadblocks. There are, in the Council, at least two permanent members, China and Russia, that are not prepared to endorse that very ambitious vision. But at the same time, they would argue that there is a growing group of countries which is close to becoming a critical mass of countries that is ready to support a more ambitious role of the international community. And so maybe that role will not be through the United Nations, if the United Nations, through the institutions of the United Nations, through the Security Council, if the Security Council is blocked. But the trend is there. Maybe it will be through informal arrangements. But that is the direction. So that debate is important, especially, I think, in the present moment of also of U.S. History with a new administration that is probably going to ask more of the United Nations than the previous administration. And so it's important to know where, I mean, are we on this notion of intervention? How ready is the world to intervene? And what can intervention achieve? And there, I mean, I hope I will not disappoint you, and I hope myself I have not become a jaded, cynical international civil servant having served too long at the United Nations. But as I address that question, I will answer with a measure of caution. And maybe you will find me too cautious on where we really are. And my first point there will be to say that this beautiful expression of international community, and in a way I have a kind of direct, almost physical experience of that international community as I've been traveling and sort of shuttling between the luxury of New York and the extreme poverty of Congo and other places. I mean, what struck me is that the international community is still more an aspiration than a reality. Yes, there are global events, but there are no global perceptions of those events. The proximity that modern means of communications, both in transportation and the media, have created is often a very superficial proximity. And what strikes me is that the intrusion of issues which we do not perceive as our issues has, if anything, reinforced our urge to, our desire to live in close rather than open communities. In other words, there's a long way from sympathy to genuine solidarity. And when I say that, I'm not just philosophizing and saying some very general, saying something very general and abstract. I mean, I have seen it in a very concrete way, because when one talks about peacekeeping, one talks about peacekeepers. And my business has been to try to find those peacekeepers. And today, they're hard to find when you come to the developed world. They're very hard to find. There's one exception, which is the European troops deployed in Lebanon. But the more dangerous the situation, the less you find developed troops in UN peacekeeping. In Africa, if you look at it, there's a certain cruel irony. That is, the weakest organization, the African Union, is in the most difficult situation, Somalia. Then the second weakest is in the second most difficult, Congo. And then you have the Europeans with a very limited mandate in Chad, in a very confined environment. So it's a kind, the riskier the mission, the less you see the most capable troops when it comes to peacekeeping. And there's a bit of a problem there. In other words, the Europeans are prepared to pay. They are not prepared to take the risks. And I heard that very clearly recently from a former prime minister in one of the important European countries, who told me, "Oh no, and we are prepared to increase our financial support to the African Union, but European troops, no, please, no." And when you see how difficult it is to create some support from a European deployment in the present tragic situation of Congo, you have a concrete illustration of that. I had a concrete illustration of that when I was trying to find troops for Darfur. And so the notion that there is a genuine appetite for intervention, to be honest, I don't see it. I see an enormous gap between the rhetoric of solidarity and the reality, which is more a reality of disengagement. So that's one point. The second point is that I think there are doubts on the very notion of intervention. And we would like to think that it's only the nasty dictators of this world who do not want the international community to intervene. Of course they do not want it. Of course they try to lobby, to manipulate the international debate, to create as many obstacles to intervention as they can. But I think it's a lack of self-awareness of the rich and powerful countries of the North to ignore the fact that many countries, and not just their dictators, but their people, have very mixed feelings on the notion of intervention. They have memories of a colonial past. They have the suspicion of double standards. They wonder who will really dictate the agenda, why this country is worthy of an intervention and not that one. And there are also unresolved issues that pop that really feed that debate. And so I think the notion that I alluded to earlier in my lecture, that it's only a diplomatic problem, that you have to convince Russia and China or go around them to have support for intervention, I think that is mistaken. I think there's much more than a diplomatic problem. I think there are very respectable democratic countries in the developing world who are wary of an interventionist agenda. Countries like India, for instance, countries like South Africa. So when we look at this debate, let's be careful that not everybody agrees. And I think if not everybody agrees, it's sometimes, let's be honest, for good reason. Because I think there are legitimate questions on the role of force. And let's make no mistake. Myself, I've been pushing a lot for a robust use of force in peacekeeping. I pushed the troop contributors to be more robust. I managed to do it with some success in 2003, 2004 in Congo. I managed to do it in Haiti. So I do see a robust use of peacekeeping to deter what I call spoilers in a peace process. That is, you need a critical mass of the key players to be on board with with whatever political process has been agreed, but you don't want that political process to be taken hostage by a few spoilers, and so it does tend to reason to raise the threshold, so to speak, by being robust enough that some militia in the midst of nowhere in Congo or some gang in the slums of Haiti is not going to bring down the whole effort. And for that, you need robustness. So I'm not, I don't think I can be suspected of underestimating the need for some robustness. At the same time, the more troops I have had under my authority, the more I have become convinced that force has its limits. And to make my point, I will use a comparison. A comparison with the role of a police in a stable country. I mean, in a country that is at peace, the police is there only for a tiny margin of the population, that is, those people who would commit crimes if they were not afraid of being caught. The vast majority of the citizenry abides by the law not because it is afraid of being caught, but because it respects the law. And that's precisely the situation that does not exist in a post-conflict situation, where there is no agreed vision of what the law should be. So any police force, any force, would be quickly overwhelmed because every person, and I say person because there is no citizen, because there is no polity, every person is a potential threat. Every gun is a challenge. And so unless you can put a policeman next to every of those potential challenges, which is impossible, you run the risk of being overwhelmed. That's why it's so important to have political processes so that you increase the percentage who have some notion of a law, of a future law, of a process that they are prepared to respect. But the notion that force will do it, I think, is naive. And force is a very blunt instrument. Force generates dynamics that you don't control, reactions and counter reactions. And so when you use force, you know where you start. You hardly know where you will end. And so as we consider peace operations, we do need to ask some hard questions. Not just how we get in, not just the laudable purpose of bringing down some nasty dictator, but how do we get out? How do we lay the foundations of what the use of force will have created? So we have to consider not just the beginnings, not just possibly the high-intensity phase of a conflict, but the phase that goes after. But we are shaped by historical experience, and I think to this day, in a way, the moral clarity of World War II inspires us and sometimes misleads us. And to have as an opponent Hitler, I mean, is an easy political choice, in a way, an easy ethical choice. But many of the situations I've been confronted to, it's not to say that there was not some very nasty people, but there was much less moral clarity. And I'm often tempted to quote Kant, as quoted by Isaiah Berlin, you know, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. Peacekeeping is a reflection of those ambiguities. It's a halfway station. It's certainly better than war, but it's not yet peace and justice. And it's a compromise. Would it be a stable compromise that just entrenches the wrong people in the absence of war, but not in a genuine peace? Will it be a compromise that lead to something that will eventually lead to genuine peace? That depends. But it reflects what the UN itself is. I'll have another quote of Dagmar Marshall this time. I mean, you know that he said the United Nations was created not to take humanity to heaven, but to save it from hell. And In peacekeeping, I think that's profoundly true. That is, we need to calibrate our ambitions, because if we overreach by pretending to make a difference in places where we can't really make a difference, we will run the risk of destroying the instrument that can make a real difference in a number of situations. There we will not have reached heaven, but we will have lost the possibility of saving from hell, communities for which the UN is actually the only hope. So let me offer in conclusion a few recommendations to try to reconcile the rhetoric of solidarity with the reality of disengagement, and to try to have a measure of engagement that is compatible with the very imperfect state of this misleading expression, the international community. And my first recommendation would be, let us not think that we can impose peace by force to unwilling partners. Let us recognize the primacy of politics. And I think today there is a tendency to throw troops at problems as if they were an answer. And there, to be frank, when you see it, when I observe, for instance, the debate in this country, you see it on the liberal side of politics as well as on the conservative side of politics. The notion that, so sometimes it's Nicholas Kristof calling for to save Darfur, or it's administration that is leaving, ready to transform the Middle East. I have my doubts on the possibility that through force you can achieve much. I think that we can coax, we can create incentives, disincentives, but we have first to manage the politics of a situation. The second policy recommendation that I would make is to the need, and it's all about politics, is to build a broad-based consensus on the political strategy of any conflict. I like to say that every conflict has, in a way, three circles. There's a circle of the direct protagonist of the conflict. There's a second circle of the regional actors, the neighbors. And there's a globe. There is the geostrategic circle, so to speak. And if at any of those three levels, key actors begin to work at cross purposes, make no mistake, it's going to fail. Because once peace has been destroyed, it's not a natural state of equilibrium to which people come back naturally. It has to be willed. It's a very complex process. And so it's much easier to derail than to put back together. And so if you have, in the international community, key actors working at cross purposes, it's almost impossible to succeed. So that need to look at the broader picture, and I could discuss it on concrete cases from Afghanistan to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and the two situations where you clearly see the various circles, the regional and the global, and the national, regional, global. If you don't fix those three circles, you're going to be in deep trouble. The third recommendation, it flows from the previous two. It's a reappraisal of the use of the role of force. And of what force can really achieve. Force can achieve a lot of things, but it's not a substitute for politics. There are some good generals who understand that. When you read a book like the book that Rupert Smith wrote, I think, last year. This is a book of a general who was confronted to the dilemmas of Yugoslavia and who knows how blunt force is, how useful force is, but how force is to be governed by a political strategy. The fourth recommendation, let's be more humble. I hear sometimes, talking about fragile states, it should be a UN trusteeship. I think it's a misunderstanding of the legitimacy of the United Nations. In a way, that was the Timor and the Kosovo moment. But we learned the hard way two things. First, the very practical thing is that it's not easy to run a country. You need a lot of technical expertise that, frankly, the United Nations has a hard time mastering. And so the technical legitimacy of the United Nations, probably we did better than in some situations. But let's not be too boastful about it. We were not that good, because it's extremely difficult. The resources are not there, the expertise. And the second, more fundamental objection to a too ambitious role is the recognition that the blue flag of the UN has more legitimacy than any national flag, especially in the context of what I was saying on, you know, the suspicion of colonialism and the rest. But at the same time, let's not overplay it. People want to run their own show. And we are not in a colonial age, even if it was the UN colonial age. And so the notion that people will welcome the very intrusive presence of the international community is mistaken. It's better to try to look for intermediate situations where you have some leverage, but at the same time, you put the problems right in the hands of the people whose future is at stake, and you let them make the decision. And it's a tough balance to recognize that it is their decision and at the same time to try to influence it. But I think the superficially easy answer that you take over doesn't really work. Fifth recommendation, which in a way flows from the previous one, the need, if we want to have leverage, short of running the show, to better orchestrate our effort. It's all about politics, but politics has to orchestrate the military, the police, the development, and we could do much better than what we are doing today. We could do much better with the bilateral donors. We could do much better with the World Bank. I mean, I have myself been very much engaged with the World Bank to bring together the World Bank with the United Nations, because the World Bank has more resources than any UN agency, and there are some very competent people there, but we often work at cross purposes. So I think there is much to be done. Another sixth recommendation, since we are just weeks away from the inauguration of a new president in the United States, and I'm not an American citizen, but the whole world seems to be willing to give advice and recommendations, so why should I stop? I will say that, of course, everything, as I said, cannot happen without a very strong engagement of the United States. The role of the United States is essential in every point I made. And that engagement, it can be at several levels. There is the most practical one, the concrete engagement. I personally believe that one thing that I did not achieve in those 8 years, and that can really deeply damage the United Nations, is to evolve the deal that presently supports peacekeeping. Let me explain. Today, we have a situation in which you have one set of countries that makes the decisions, that essentially the Security Council and the Security Council, the permanent members of the Council. You have one set of countries that pays the bill, which is essentially US, Europe, and Japan. And you have one set of countries that takes the risks, and as I said, that essentially developing countries. That is not today a sustainable deal. Because especially if you have more and more ambitious mandates, and more ambitious mandates mean more risk. It's not going to, and today we are seeing it tragically unraveling in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. If one is serious about this operational role of the United Nations in peacekeeping, one needs to have a different burden sharing, and so one will need troops from developed countries. Now, I know very well that all the reluctance of developed countries with UN command and control arrangements, a variety of things, I'm not going to get into now, because I see time is running out. But all that can be discussed. My point, and evolve, my point is that if you keep that separation between those three constituencies, which only very partially overlap, you weaken the efficiency, you undermine the legitimacy, you really are destroying something fundamental. You have to change that, and the U.S., in my view, should consider how it could engage, including on the military front, in peacekeeping. I think it would be a very strong signal, as the Europeans should. Of course, part of changing that deal is the reform of the Security Council. I believe that is something that continues to be necessary, that the notion that informal arrangement will do it doesn't work, because informal arrangements will never have the legitimacy of formal arrangements. I mean, you know that for courts. I mean, what would citizens say if you said, "Oh, well, this court is not functioning. Let's have an informal arrangement." You can have that in very specific areas, but at some point it doesn't work. And it's I think the point can be made for the international relations. So you need a reform of the Security Council, but one has to recognize that this is very difficult, this is very dangerous. If it fails, it can set us back further. And so it has to be prepared by a political engagement on what are international institutions for. And in a way, that's the most important contribution, in my personal view, that the United States can make. That is to try to rebuild a sense of common purpose, to try to rebuild a broad-based international consensus, which will probably be less ambitious than the ambitious views that I described, but at the same time, which would not be back to just going back to sovereignty. And it's an intermediate progress that is, in my view, possible. But if that is to happen, it requires very strong engagement of the United States. And after all, when I understand the new president was started in politics as a community organizer, and so I think now, I mean, he has his work cut out for himself. He needs to organize the international community. It's a bit unruly, it's a bit difficult, but it's worth it. Thank you.